Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for a bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. With me today is my regular co-host, Cleveland area attorney and Republican factotum, Jay Carson.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you today?
I'm doing good.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty much okay myself, too. We have over the last couple weeks, as you've been sailing the high seas or what have you, you're not a pirate or anything like that, a much-deserved break. We've had a number of listener questions sort of pile up, and so we have a bunch of things to talk about today. So if you are ready, we can just kind of plunge right in.
Yeah, let's plunge right in.
Okay, here we go. Let's see. Well, a number of listeners commented on our discussion of the zero tolerance and family separation policies. There were a bunch of people who were disappointed, I'd say even outraged to a certain extent, with your take, Jay. And I tried to kind of put a lot of them together into sort of one mega comment.
A lot of outrage.
Yeah, well, you know. Peg, there was a comment from Peg on what became pretty a lively Facebook discussion. I think it does a good job of summing things up. She says, Jay is concerned that the little girl on Time is not actually a girl who was separated. The left doesn't correct its error. Jay, have you held Fox and Breitbart responsible? Also, the separated girls cannot be checked on or found in some cases. I'm very disappointed that Jay has the gall to totally spew the party line on this one. Now, in the same conversation, I believe, Joe added, Jay got a good workout this week punching his mainstream media straw man. And then Peter commented, Jay's biggest issue is the Time magazine cover? Grow a soul, dude. In a response to the episode in the comments section on our website, politicsguys.com, so you can comment on things there, Brian wrote in part, and I kind of edited this a little bit for brevity, false equivalencies, ginned up outrage, specious rhetoric, obfuscation, and deflection. This really does seem to be all that Jay has to offer this program anymore. This is not argument. I know this is not argument in good faith. It's not bipartisan debate. It's not illuminating party ideology. It is precisely the kind of grotesque doublespeak that has incrementally eroded the public's faith in institutions and their fellow human beings and allowed some of the worst atrocities in history to eventuate. It is shameful that the Politics Guys, a program whose purview I so admired, is willing to sink so low. Like I said, there was some outrage, obviously, a lot of comments and so forth.
So to sum up, my point was, the mainstream media, if they're using pictures to illustrate their stories, ought to have pictures that are actually illustrative of their stories. And the takeaway is worst atrocities in history. So, I mean, I'll leave that to the listeners to decide. I mean, what we were talking about was media coverage of separation story. And I will absolutely stand by my guns that when a media outlet, and I don't care whether it's CNN or Fox or whomever, if they take photos, which are extremely powerful and are used to tell the story, and they use those photos out of context knowingly, they're doing a real disservice to journalism. They're doing a disservice to their readers, and I think ought to be called out on it.
You know, and I agree.
I mean,
and
that's really not, I don't think, a radical sort of notion.
No, I agree to a point. I'll say I think you're absolutely right, and you gave a lot of other examples of that, how that was done. You mentioned George H.W. Bush and the scanner.
Scanning the socks, yeah.
Thing. I mentioned the O.J.'s face being blackened and made more to look more sinister, that sort of thing.
Okay. And same thing was done for a McCain cover.
Okay, there you go. So, and I think in those instances, here's where I make a distinction, and I think this is maybe where we'll disagree a little bit. If there is an illustration or a photo that the average person would think was essentially a real picture in a sense, like an accurate depiction, as opposed to say like a caricature or a drawing or something like that.
Political cartoon, yes.
Then altering those things is wrong. Now, that's why my take was a little different than yours on the Time cover, because I find it hard to believe that anyone thought that President Trump was a few feet away from this crying child kind of looming over her, and that this happened against a blood red background under a blood red sky, you know? So
that's usually how those things happen.
Exactly. But
when
so
Trump
to me,
across small children, that's usually when where he does it.
Yeah. But to me, that's why I think that was not, the same category as some of the things that you talked about that I also deplore. But I think the larger point that some listeners felt like was that both of us, and I'll say maybe me too as well, because I think I was the one that brought up the time cover since it was part of I brought it up because it was part of what people were talking about. But feeling that in talking about something as inconsequential as the cover of this dying news magazine thing, which, you know, so many of our listeners have probably never even seen, and you know, it's been a decade since I've seen an actual Time magazine, that we're spending a lot of time on this completely unimportant little thing when we should really be focusing on the real issue. And you know, I think maybe there's some fairness. And again, this I think is on me just as much as on you, Jay. That I brought it up and you responded to it, and maybe our time could have been better spent talking on something of more substance than that. But I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, but it's our show, and again, that's in a lot of ways. I mean, look, we had talked at length earlier on the policy part of the separation. But to me, I'm going to really stand my ground on this because this is important. Pictures tell a tremendous story.
Sure, absolutely. Very,
you know,
powerful.
One of the absolutely enduring images. I mean, think about through American history, the girl running naked in Vietnam who'd been napalmed, by American bombings. That told a tremendous story. That changed the narrative. That changed what a lot of people thought about the Vietnam War. And that picture was accurate.
But what do you think about my point? I mean, do you think the comment I made about
I would say, but here's the thing. I don't think anyone actually believed that Trump was actually standing at the border behind a blood red sky, personally separating children from families. At least most people probably didn't. And that you could see that as this is just this is a collage of types that Time's putting together. But to me, that the fact that the crying girl picture was used before that to illustrate all these stories of separations, when in fact there wasn't a separation, and then was continued to be used, knowing that this child was not separated.
I sort of see your point. Okay,
that's where I'm coming from on this.
Let me see if I understand.
Let me just finish this.
But
imagine if the story had been different. Imagine if the picture had been reported accurately. And say, here is a picture of it. You know, here a crying child. A child cries as her mother is searched while crossing the border. That tells a really different story, doesn't it, than a child crying when separated from mother and she'll never see her again. I mean, that's
okay. Yeah, you know, sorry for interrupting. I'm trying to get a little better handle on where I think you're coming from, and sort of I think are maybe some of our points of agreement. And so it seems to me that there's maybe a distinction that can be made between, well, things that are accurate and things that are inflammatory. And things can certainly be accurate and inflammatory,
Absolutely.
Things can be accurate and unnecessary.
The best things are.
Yeah, good point. The picture of the naked girl running from the... But in this case, you're saying this was inaccurate and inflammatory.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and
intentionally so.
And you know, I guess there's a part of me that is sympathetic to where you're coming from. I mean, I'm torn a little bit on this, in that I feel like if you are going to be inflammatory, then it's better to be accurate in your depiction. And you know, I've railed for years against the inflammatory nature of the media and kind of stirring up this sort of, now in some instances, I think that can be incredibly useful, but I mean, it is fair to say that there were plenty of accurate and inflammatory, rightly inflammatory issues about this, and maybe what Time chose to do here was, I guess I would say what bugs me about it is it was perhaps lazy, I guess you could say, maybe a little
bit. Well, I'd say lazy and disingenuous.
See, that's where we kind of park grounds. But
you know, but here's you make a good point in that. Look, there were a lot of other probably real photographs that would have accurately depicted what they're trying to say. Yet they chose not to use those. And that sort of tells a story. And look, this isn't anything new. And I will even go back to Paul Revere did this, right? He did the engravings of the Boston Massacre, most likely, again, because we didn't have the pictures to prove it. But from most accounts, Revere's depiction is sort of an over the top view of British soldiers, you know, massacring, sort of peaceful protesters. When in fact it was sort of a melee all around, and the colonists throwing rocks and snowballs and so forth, and then shots were fired. But again, that's to me that brings to mind the importance of pictures in illustrating political stories, and the need that you really need to get it correct, especially if it's going to be, as you said, an inflammatory type image.
Yeah, to me, I mean, all you need to do is just see some of the actual documentary footage, and that is enough, and it's much more powerful, I think, in a certain way. But in the end, I think I think Time magazine, I think one of their latest covers now is of Trump morphing into Putin's face and that sort of thing. And to me, the whole Time magazine cover thing, which we've heard a number of times before, is just a desperate attempt by a dying institution to try to retain some cultural cachet by being ridiculously over the top. And I almost feel embarrassed that we're spending time falling right into their trap. But so mea culpa on this one, I guess. So, but maybe we can move on if you're okay with that. Okay.
Well, yeah. So on to further atrocities.
Yeah. Well, Ryan wrote in, I'm curious to hear Jay's thoughts on Chevron deference and how Gorsuch wants to do away with it. From my understanding of Chevron, it would allow courts to hold more power in deciding policy. Instead of this flip-flopping you have when the White House changes hands, the law would be more settled. Does Jay find it good or bad that Gorsuch is pushing to remove this? Would he feel the same if he is fine with it if this is being pushed by a Ginsburg-type judge? Where does Mike fall on the issue with Trump packing the courts with right-wing judges? Also, I'm curious to know if you think that the recent ruling on state sales taxes is connected with the Chevron question, seeing how I believe Chevron means the courts can more easily decide policy. So I think to answer this question, first we need to kind of let listeners know what Chevron deference... Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on there. So Jay, maybe you could explain to listeners what Chevron deference is.
Chevron deference comes out of a 1978, I want to say, Supreme Court case that involved the EPA. And the idea was when an administrative agency makes a rule or makes a decision, how much deference should be given to that agency. And the Chevron case, the court said, look, we've got to give a whole lot of deference to the agency's determination, unless it is on its face unreasonable. The reasoning behind that is that in areas where we have agencies operating, for example, the EPA, for the FTC, the SEC, they're often dealing with some really hyper-technical knowledge that they are better equipped to make than, say, a court with general knowledge. So if there's questions about which pollutants ought to be on this, on the list, or what type of substances ought to be defined as pollutants or not, that's a better question for the EPA to determine than it is for a court to determine. Likewise, if you're talking about the SEC or the FTC, the regulators there have better in-depth knowledge of the really complex financial and economic actions that they're regulating. So the court ought to defer and not impose its view in deciding these questions.
Yeah, and I would say that that makes perfect sense to me. And I'm a big fan of judicial restraint and the court not imposing its view, which is why, you know, I certainly hold to that view. And Justice Gorsuch, though, has a bit of a different take on it, right?
Well, but there's another way to look at this, and that is not that the courts ought to, or other proper place to make these decisions, but rather it should be made in Congress. And that what's happening, has happened, is that Congress gives much too much power and deference to administrative agencies, and is in fact assigning its lawmaking function to the administrative agencies, which right. which is an unconstitutional delegation of authority. So I think the argument, first of all, would this give courts more power? I would say, yes and no. What it would do is give courts more power to sort of hold Congress's feet to the fire. And I think we'll talk a little bit more because I want to get into Gorsuch specifically.
Because yeah, in practice, wouldn't it mean that? I mean, it seems to me that in practice, what it means is that judges and justices feel more comfortable striking down administrative actions, which in a sense is imposing their own judgment in the place of these administrative agencies,
right.
which to me is again just a form of judicial activism that I have major problems with.
Well, I think the route that you could go is certainly to say, listen, the statute is silent on this or that, or this is not a question for the administration in promulgating this rule exceeded its statutory authority. It needs to go back to Congress to get that statutory authority.
And I think that that's a good point. I mean, because I think that certainly when an agency exceeds its authority or goes outside of its authority in some way, well, that's a different case than the agency making a determination, you know, as to what something within the authority granted to Congress gives them. And you point out that issue of unconstitutional delegations of power. I would call that a separate but related issue to this.
Okay.
So anyway, the other thing I'm not. So I guess that answers the question from my standpoint is I am very much in favor of Chevron deference, regardless of who happens to be on the court, regardless of who is packing the courts, whether it's Donald Trump or, you know, a Democratic president, just because of my basic stance on judicial activism. I'm not really clear exactly how the recent ruling on state sales taxes connects into that. Jay, I don't know, maybe you can address that a little bit.
I'm not necessarily following that either. I don't see a deference question there other than are we saying that the IRS has this, you know, this broader authority? To me, it's almost the opposite type thing. We're saying that the and maybe that's what the question is asking, that the IRS ought to be given deference in terms of how in creating or enforcing a national policy on sales tax.
I think in this case it was that was it that oh I see what you're saying, because even though it's state sales tax, there's the question of how they're
how it's collected and is there essentially like federal preemption or something like that. I wouldn't think there would be at this point, but could there be? Yeah, I think, you know, that's a different question. Could Congress create some sort of system to collect state sales taxes nationwide, that it's a standardized system, and we say it's a commerce thing, states say no, it's a state thing, and you have that fight. But more to Gorsuch. The opinions that have been cited where he has criticized Chevron heavily and in some ways correctly. I mean, he basically said, look, this is a completely judge-made doctrine. There's nothing legislatively or constitutionally that compels this. This is just sort of the courts, you know, made this up as their own rule. And he's absolutely right about that. But the cases where he has criticized deference had to do with the INS, for example. and it involved due process issues. And his argument was sort of, look, and you can make this differentiation between there's deference due when an agency is exercising its own particular expertise in that field versus when the agency is making sort of more general rules of law.
Okay.
So the, you know, look, if the EPA is talking about, here's the list of what ought to be considered pollutants, here's the list of what ought to be considered wetlands. Well, maybe that's a different case. But in the INS case, it was sort of, well, here's what constitutes due process for people who are charged with violating these rules. And you know, I think Kavanaugh's point was, look, this is something that the courts can certainly handle. There's no particular or technical expertise. In fact, this is exactly what the courts are supposed to do, is look at these sort of questions. So, you know, I don't know that Kavanaugh's had that many of these regulatory questions, simply because so many of them come up through the D.C. Circuit. He was on the 10th Circuit. But I don't read, and I don't see Kavanaugh moving the court towards a all-out abandonment of Chevron. I think there might be sort of a tightening of, here's what's a reasonable interpretation, here's what's not. But I don't think that I don't see a wholesale throwing it out, especially when it comes to, again, decisions that are technical in nature, right, as opposed, right, to general.
Right. Well, and I think one thing we can say that both you and I agree on is that anything that means the courts can more easily decide policy is something that we are very strongly inclined to not be all that crazy about.
Right. And I would say the conservative position for years and years and years and forever has been there ought to be less policy made through rulemaking and more policy made through Congress. The Congress ought to do the hard work and draft more specific statutes and not farm it out to administrative agencies for some of those very, very reasons. I mean, one, it creates more predictability in the law. It creates it preserves sort of a balance of power between Congress and the administration. And, you know, I think one of the worst aspects of, for example, the Affordable Care Act was how much of it was done by rulemaking and not through Congress.
And there's a reason why. It's just really hard to do. I mean,
well,
politically.
It's politically hard to do. And you know, there's also, look, there's levels of how deep you want to wade in, but certainly, you know, so many statutes you look at, are federal statutes are incredibly brief and sort of like, it sets forth a, here's a goal we'd like, and we authorize the Department of whatever to promulgate rules to affect that. And really that's not, you know, I think in a lot of ways, Congress is sort of abandoning its role. And,
right.
And if,
no,
if judges push back harder and make Congress do its work, I think that's a healthy thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. Okay. Let's see. Daniel writes, I have heard Mike and Jay discuss regulations, speaking of regulations, on the show a number of times. Both seem to agree that in general, the market is much more efficient and effective than government regulations. However, I'm curious to know how this applies to specifically environmental regulations. Since it is usually cheaper, at least in the short run, for companies to damage the environment than to adopt policies that don't, what is the market force to drive them to protect the environment? Doesn't this make environmental regulations wholly necessary? Further, since environmental cost is not usually included in the price of a good, don't environmental regulations help correct the market failure by reducing the negative externality of environmental damage and bring that market closer to a socially optimal point? I'm very curious what your perspective is on this. Thank you for your time. And he added a PS. I love the show. It has definitely brought me to more to the center from the left. There you go, Jay.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, I'm getting somewhere.
And forced me to see things from a different perspective. Keep it up.
Thank you.
So, Jay, well, I mean, I think this is a little more addressed to you, at least initially, because I think I'm much more in agreement with what sounds to me like Daniel's view on environmental regulation and market failure. So what do you think?
Well, let me ask you this. I'm imagining you've, well, maybe not. Did you drink any coffee this morning?
I did, in fact.
Okay. And what kind of coffee was that?
What do you mean?
Well, was it, you know, for example, we used to do advertisements for a coffee company.
Blue Bottle.
And they would promote themselves based on their sustainability practices.
Yes. In fact, the coffee I drank,
was a big seller for you.
Was fair trade coffee. Absolutely.
Well, to me, that's the type of how we see environmentalism being enforced in the market, is that consumers, when given a choice, will typically, you know, they'll have the choice of paying more, maybe a little bit more, for a product that they know is whatever, organic, friendly farmed, sustainably farmed, fair traded, and so forth. And those companies tend to do well, and there's pressure on other suppliers then to bring that, do the same, to say we are whatever ethically sourced or whatever it is you're, you know, not made with any chemicals. So that does work in the marketplace.
I don't think that's what Daniel's talking about. I think he's talking more about, like, for instance, it would be a lot cheaper to make, say, the steel for whatever cars or something, if you didn't have to have scrubbers installed or something like that. Now, that might not damage the environment today, but in 10 years, it would. I think that's more thing that he's talking about. At least that's my sense.
Okay. Well, in that case, no, I think there would be a place for regulation, because there's not necessarily a market, you know, for environmentally clean steel. And, and again, it's one of those, I don't know that there's, you're sort of setting an industry standard there. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not as if, you know, this, I don't know. I mean, I guess in that case, I think, you should have some environmental regulations, and that those, I'm not saying that the free market can do all of that,
right.
But, so maybe I'm misunderstanding the question.
No, I think you are understanding the question. I think, you know, you're not. I mean, certainly, I think there are some listeners who think that you've never met a regulation that you like. But I think this is just one area.
The rat feces one, remember?
There you go. When we're dealing with these sort of negative externalities that the market doesn't price in, it sounds to me like you don't have a problem with at least targeted government regulation that deals with that in some way. Now, there are different ways to deal with it. You might, for instance, be more in favor of something along the lines of, say, a carbon tax, which in fact was an idea. That
it was a Republican idea, yes,
Republican
before it was an Al Gore idea.
Absolutely. So you know, that kind of thing. So you might be more in favor of the tax system doing that than the regulatory system, but you certainly are not blind to the idea that just as government can fail, markets can fail, and in that case, things need to be done and by government.
Yeah, I think that's right. But you know, the other concern that I raised last time we had this discussion was also that when you have too much regulation and you have an industry that has powerful lobbying, you can end up with this sort of soft corruption or crony capitalism type situation where an industry can raise the cost of entry so high that they can keep out competitors.
Sure.
You know, for example, maybe there could be a lot of steel made that is more efficient, more productive, better for everybody by small mills, but they can't afford all of the regulatory pieces that they'd have to get the approvals to start a steel mill.
Right.
And in that way, what you're doing is sort of subsidizing the big guys who are still polluting, even though they've got scrubbers, they're still polluting, and you're stifling innovation. And that's the issues that I have. So I'm not saying that all regulations are bad, but they ought to be the default should be, you know, is this regulation necessary? What effect does it have on other people who might be entering the marketplace? And what effect does it have on innovation?
Sure, that should always be consideration. Absolutely. Okay, let's see here. Dave writes, I was wondering if you could circle back to the ICE conversation you had a while back. It says, in regards to eliminating immigration and customs, the Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Agency, I think there's a conservative argument for it. I understand the calls to abolish ICE are coming from the left, And Jay's reaction, and Mike's as well, I suppose, is to assume the idea is basically stupid and hysterical.
That's a good.
But he says, but let's take away all the current news stories and look at ICE for what it is. A relatively new federal agency, 15 years old. There were already a bunch of government agencies doing this work. This one was more expensive and expanded the power of the federal government. Usually, Jay's response to an agency with these characteristics tends to be something like, government agencies seek to increase their budget and increase their sphere of influence. And that's why they're often as much or more of a problem as the thing they're trying to fix. And then the federal government is just bigger and more expensive. And because we should be wary of creating new agencies. This was basically Jay's argument against the CFPB. And let's see. And the CFPB caught Wells Fargo literally stealing money from Americans, which means the CFPB literally protects Americans from crime. I like that Dave put that in there. I didn't. That wasn't mine. But anyway, so protecting Americans from crime isn't apparently enough for every agency to exist. And I know that Jay doesn't buy into a hysterical, Mexico is sending us their rapists and murderers anti-immigrant mindset. There are no illegal immigration statistics I've seen to suggest that there's an imminent threat that ICE alone addresses that supersedes good governance. So, do we need ICE? To be clear, I'm in favor of law enforcement, and I'm not in favor of open borders. With our bazillion law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies, is Immigration and Customs Enforcement just another bloated government agency in search of a reason for being? As always, thanks for the great podcast. I really like that question because it really does take something that we've been talking about and put an entirely different spin on it. I was definitely interested in getting your reaction to that, Jay.
Yeah, no, I think you make some good points. Could the functions of ICE be better absorbed by some other agency? Maybe. That could well be, and I don't think I'd be opposed to something like that. What the sense I get, though, from what's coming from the left, and again, I'll use that phrase kind of loosely, the radical left, is not that they are concerned with government efficiency and should these agencies be combined? Is it a duplicative of some other government organizations out there? But rather, they just don't want the laws enforced. So that said, I think that's where I'm coming from, and I agree. I think the laws ought to be enforced, whether it's done by, ICE or whether it's done by some other agency. I think that's different. And in terms of where I come down on, I guess the hierarchy of what the federal government's supposed to do, defending our borders is pretty high on there. For example, the CFPB, my sense was those claims could have been handled through civil fraud suits rather than creating a new organization.
And this is where I bite my tongue, right? So we don't get into another. Yes. Right. But yeah, I understand. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
This to me, and I'd say to most conservatives, they don't look at economic regulation as a this is something fundamentally that we need the federal government to do. They do look at border security as something we fundamentally need the federal government to do. So I think that's why I would first of all put that ahead of, I guess the first question I tend to ask when we're talking about any sort of government intervention is, okay, is this something the private sector can handle? Well, yes or no? Well, no, not really. Is this something that the state governments can handle? Well, maybe to some point, but do we need a broader policy? Third is, look, this is something that is really constitutionally given to the federal government to do, and it also fits in that sort of core competencies of what the federal government ought to do.
Yeah. And, if I understand the history of ICE, if I remember the history of ICE correctly, after 9/11, basically there were before that, sorry, there were a number of agencies that handled various aspects of things, and a lot of them were kind of brought in, well, of course, to Homeland Security, and then into, you know, ICE. Before that, we had the Customs Service did some stuff,
right.
INS did some stuff, the Federal Protective Service did some stuff, and so
Border Patrol did stuff, and it may well make sense administratively to combine all those into ICE, or it may not,
right?
But regardless, that job needs to be done.
Yeah, certainly. Absolutely. Okay. Let's see here. You know, there were, I tried again.
And let me, you know, I'm going to expand. And that job means capturing, detaining, bringing to the appropriate agencies for trial and disposition, and then deporting people who violate immigration laws.
Sure. Well, yeah. That's.
And I think that's the difference. The folks on the left who are calling for ICE to be abolished are pretty much opposed to those goals. I mean, regardless of what the agency that does it.
Well, I mean, there are some open borders people and that sort of thing, but
right. But like Trey.
Yeah, Trey is more open borders certainly than either you or I are. But to me, the fundamental issue, and I've said this before, with the abolish ICE is they are carrying out policy directives that they've received from above, and so I don't think the problem is them. I think the problem is those policy directives. You know, you change those, and that's really the real problem. But all right, so one final, well, it's a question from a number of listeners. I'll kind of combine it basically. And Ryan was one listener who wrote in here. I think it was a different Ryan. He writes, some food for thought that really shows the difference between the left and right. Jay, for as smart as he is, that's, you know, it starts out nice.
Thank you, Ryan.
Toes the line. He agreed with everything SCOTUS did, and there was no introspection into why he came to that. He just agreed because he agreed on the policy. Where with Mike, I've noticed he will sit down, research, and come up with an answer to the issue at hand, which is what I most enjoy about the show. And there was another listener who wrote in, my sense is that Jay deviates from political orthodoxy much less than Mike. Both of you could do more of this, but from Jay in particular, I feel like I'm getting a robotic recitation of the right's position, which is both uninteresting, because I know what it is, or infuriating, because it feels like playing tennis with a brick wall. I'm not asking Jay to come to different policy preferences all the time, but at least to engage with where his views might be standing on weaker or stronger ground, or more honestly engage with why the other side disagrees. So, yeah, okay.
Well, I don't know how to respond to that other than we just went through this thing where I said I'm okay with lots of regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledge the federal government's role in regulation, and I'm not sure exactly which Supreme Court decisions we're talking about.
I think it was just, if I recall correctly, that when we talked about all the court's decisions, you were on board with all of them, and I wasn't on board with some of them.
Right.
Is my sense. But,
that just shows that, yeah, you're right some of the time.
Well, you know, seriously, though, I think maybe part of the reason for this is that I am a much less orthodox liberal than you are an orthodox conservative. You know, I mean, I break, and I think that's just a function of my history, you know, because I used to be on your side on pretty much everything, right? To the right of you.
You used to be to the right of me.
Yeah, on pretty much everything. And so I still kept some of those inclinations when I moved to the left. And so I just think my personal political philosophy, I have more that I still keep from my time on the right. And you know, I think you never spent any time on the left, so naturally
never ventured into the fever swamps.
There you go. So, I think part of that just our, you know, our histories, and I've kind of made that journey from the darkness into the light, and you've stayed in the darkness. So, you know, that's going to have an effect.
You know, I would say also that I think so often, again, it's pretty funny because I'll talk to conservative friends. And get lambasted for being too weak, too squishy, too moderate on so many things. And I think there's also a function of what media people consume. I would say our listenership is demographic show much more to the left than to the right.
Yep. We have a healthy number of people on the right, but yeah, it's definitely more left to center.
And that probably goes more to just people who listen to podcasts, period.
Yeah, I would guess. It's
nothing with us specifically, but just the ages and the people who listen to podcasts. So I guess sometimes something that I will say will come off as being, pretty much doctrinaire conservative, when really there are a lot of other conservative positions that just don't show up in the mainstream media. There's really a lively debate, and has been for a while, on Donald Trump, right or wrongly, what do Republicans do with Donald Trump now, and what do we do with this sense of the populist movement and so forth? And there are I think to the extent I appear doctrinaire, I apologize. I can assure you I'm not.
Well, you're no Sean Hannity. That's
yeah,
for sure.
It's
that would be pretty rough for me to handle on a week to week basis, I think.
Yeah, and look, and in truth, we've talked about this before. I really don't think I've ever watched an entire episode of Sean Hannity's show. I don't listen to Rush Limbaugh. Occasionally, if like I'm in the middle of nowhere, I'm flipping through the dial and I'll listen to some of it, but it's not something I do regularly. I don't read Breitbart. I don't read Red State or Free Republic or those. It's to say I'm a, I don't know. It's weird because in many ways I feel out of tune with what's going on. In the Republican sure. Party. So I'm perplexed as how to best respond to that criticism. So other than saying I am who I am. So,
no, I mean, I think it comes up every once in a while, and for listeners who haven't heard it in some of its previous iterations, I think it's important to understand sort of where we're coming from, and the fact that if you were, as Jay, as you point out, the sort of person who consumed a lot of those media outlets that you mentioned, you would think that Jay is this flaming liberal who is doing great damage to the country and is a apostate and a heretic from the true conservative faith, sort of thing. So a lot does depend on sort of where you're coming from on that, I think, for sure. All right. Before we finish, I know Jay that you've been sailing the high seas and so forth. So you do not have a what we're reading for this week, but I will put in a couple of things then to kind of make up for it. So
yeah, okay.
One is a while back on our Facebook group, we're both big fans of Jonah Goldberg, right?
Yes.
Even though politically a lot of times I don't agree with him, and so I asked myself, is there like a Jonah Goldberg of the left? And I couldn't think of anyone. And I looked and looked, and finally I just put it up on Facebook and said to the group, is there anyone you can think of? And I heard a few answers. And actually, our own Ken Katkin gave me a suggestion. And it was a pretty good one, it turns out. Charles Pierce, who writes for Esquire, of all places, suggested I check him out. And he actually does have a little bit of that kind of Jonah Goldberg vibe, but he's coming at it from the left. And so now I have become a regular reader of Charles Pierce. So if you are someone who tried Jonah Goldberg but thought it's a little too right wing for me, you might want to check out Charles Pierce. I recommend him. Secondly, there was this fascinating chart that I saw this week. It was actually in the New York Times. They did a comparison of what it takes to get an abortion in California versus in Mississippi. And it was wow. It was like two entirely different worlds. And it really kind of brought in place the fact that when we're talking about these restrictions on abortion services, that wow, where you live can make a huge difference. It was a really interesting graphic, regardless of how you feel about it. I mean, you might say, well, it's way too easy in California, or it's way too hard in Mississippi. But that kind of stark difference was really opened my eyes in a pretty interesting way. And so I'll put that up there as well.
Okay.
All right. So that does it for this week's show, unless you have anything, Jay.
No, nothing really. Other than, I'm just kind of getting back into the working world again.
I've been a couple of weeks without you. It's definitely good to to have you back. So, all right, everyone, thanks for listening to this episode. We do hope you like what you heard. And of course, listener support is what keeps the show going. We really do appreciate it. So if you can help us out, that would be great. Just go to politicsguys.com/support. That's a direct link. Or if you just go to politicsguys.com, you can click on support in the menu or click on the Patreon or PayPal links you'll find there. Also, subscribing to the show makes a big difference, as does sharing episodes and leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes. If you want to get in touch with us, we're at mail@politicsguys.com. There's also our Facebook page where you can message us and where we post stuff throughout the week. That's facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter at politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you join us.